Hello les distordus! Si vous aimez Distorsion, vous allez sans aucun doute adorer le balado Dérive disponible sur Radio-Canada Audio. Tout comme nous, le pharmacien et vulgarisateur scientifique Olivier Bernard adore démystifier des phénomènes scientifiques et dans la troisième saison du balado Dérive, intitulé « Les secrets de la mafia médicale », Olivier étudie le parcours de ces scientifiques qui ont défendu des idées marginales ou même dangereuses et dévoile leur impact méconnu sur la société. Le tout en s'appuyant sur l'histoire incroyable du chanteur québécois Bernard Lachance, décédé du sida en 2021, maladie dont il niait l'existence. Personnellement, j'ai dévoré le balado d'un bout à l'autre en un week-end, rivé à mes écouteurs. Dérive ainsi que plusieurs autres balados pour tous les goûts, dont plusieurs balados d'enquête et de mystère, sont disponibles en exclusivité sur Radio-Canada Audio. Téléchargez dès maintenant l'appli Radio-Canada Audio sur les plateformes Apple ou Android. Bonne écoute! Sébastien Lévesque, comment ça va aujourd'hui?
Ça va bien, et toi, Émile Gauthier?
Ça va très bien parce qu'on reçoit un invité de marque, là, une grosse prise pour Distorsion aujourd'hui. On reçoit le journaliste Evan Ratliff, qui est basé à New York. On avait entendu parler de lui il y a environ une dizaine d'années. Evan Ratliff, il avait fait à l'époque là, la couverture du magazine Wired parce qu'il avait décidé là, de disparaître pendant quelques mois, disparaître dans la nature en laissant quelques traces numériques pour que les lecteurs de Wired le retrouve. Donc, c'était une expérimentation assez intéressante. Et justement, ben, il avait fait la couverture de Wired avec ça. Ça avait été une grosse histoire qui nous avait beaucoup inspiré à Distorsion.
Oui, vraiment. Puis c'était une époque avant Facebook, avant la masse de réseaux sociaux. Donc, le monde numérique était vraiment différent là, quand il expérimentait ça comparativement aujourd'hui.
Exactement. Et puis, ce qui arrive, c'est que l'an dernier, Evan Ratliff a récidivé, il a écrit un livre sur Paul Leroux, dont on a parlé là, dans un épisode en deux parties très récemment. Paul Leroux, qui est un grand cybercriminel qui a monté un empire sur le web, là, allant de la vente illégale de médicaments jusqu'au trafic de drogue, jusqu'au trafic d'armes, même jusqu'à engager des mercenaires pour faire assassiner des gens. Donc, c'est quelqu'un qu'on a très peu entendu parler, je dirais, dans la francophonie, mais qui a fait beaucoup de vagues, surtout aux États-Unis, parce que Paul Leroux est devenu un informateur pour la DEA. Et bien, Evan Ratliff, lui, a réussi à retracer l'histoire de Paul Leroux et sa montée au sein de cet empire du web. Et puis, on trouvait que c'était important de tenter de le rejoindre, du moins parce que lorsqu'on a fait nos épisodes, eh bien, on n'a pas eu le choix de s'inspirer beaucoup de son livre, étant donné que c'est un des seuls qui est allé vraiment aussi loin dans son investigation. On va pouvoir discuter justement du cas de la disparition à l'ère numérique, de son article de Wired qu'il a fait il y a environ 10 ans. Et évidemment, eh bien, on va revenir sur l'histoire de Paul Leroux parce qu'on a plein de questions pour lui. Donc, sans plus tarder, on s'en va rejoindre le journaliste Evan Ratliff qui est localisé à New York, mais on va le rejoindre à distance. Et c'est parti!
Oui, monsieur!
So, hey, Evan, it's a pleasure to have you on Distorsion. I hope you're doing well. Are you still in New York right now?
I am not currently in New York. I'm actually in Delaware. I was in New York up until a couple of weeks ago, but I'm just getting a couple of weeks away from being in the city. But I'm doing fine. Considering I live in a failed state, I'm doing fine.
Yeah, that's a good point. Could you tell us a little bit more about your technology and investigative journalism background? Because looking at most of the articles that you've written and also the book that you've written, technology seems to be at the center of your work.
It is. Yeah, it often is. That's partly because that's sort of how I got into journalism in the first place. I actually was a sort of programmer, not a very good programmer, but I, out of college, I worked as a kind of computer consultant where I did some programming and software installation. So I had a technical background to understand that stuff. And then I got my first job, the only journalism job I could get at the time, an internship at Wired Magazine, partly because I had that technical knowledge. So even from the beginning of my career, I was sort of coming out of a world of trying to explain the way technology was changing the world, and all of the stories that I've been interested in are either science or technology somewhere is in there. And then over time, I kind of branched out to be more of a generalist, but I still often return to those roots, partly because when I started, it was still sort of technology was this fringe, not fringe, but it was something that was sort of outside of a lot of people's experience or considered outside of a lot of people's experience. And now, of course, it's taken over everyone's experience. And so every story pretty much has some sort of technical dimension to it.
Yeah, and that's really true. And how is it or how was it to work at Wired back in the day? Because it looks like a dream job for any journalist interested in technology in general.
It was. I mean, it was pretty wild because I arrived in 1999, I think, 98, okay. 99. And so that was in the middle of the dot-com boom. So it was a strange time because you had just everything happening everywhere, you know, companies launching and throwing big parties and just ridiculous, you know, overkill when it came to what companies were spending. And of course there was, for a lot of them, there was nothing underneath it. There was no revenue or anything, but it was a good time to be at Wired magazine in particular, because there were so many stories to write and there was also so many pages to fill. There was so much advertising and it was just a flush time. Of course, you know, cut to a year and a half later and the dot-com boom collapsed and then we were in a different world. So I got to see the kind of boom and bust almost right from the beginning of my career. But yeah, it was. I mean, it was a dream job because I was learning about journalism and how to report stories and how to write stories. I had not trained in journalism. So I was learning that at the same time that it felt like technology was really kind of having an impact in the world that it had not had previously. And it was kind of entering people's lives. So that combination of things made it, you know, a pretty exciting time. I think it was hard for Wired and for a while there too, because they had it all to themselves. Like not that many places would cover these type of stories. And then suddenly everyone was covering these types of stories and it became a different thing to try to explain this stuff to everyone.
Yeah. And there was also, you're talking about 1999, Y2K was around the corner at the same time. So I guess it was something to see from the inside.
Yeah. It was like, we had it all. We had excess in the economy. We had apocalypse coming, you know, it was just the beginning of sort of cyber crime too, being a thing where you could really kind of, you know, make money. So the like utopian side of it was there. They were still at that time. It's funny now you look at the internet, but people were still, you know, just really excited about the internet as a home for free, unfettered free speech and things like that. So there was this optimist utopian view. And then there was this sort of dystopia that was starting to creep in. So from a perspective of telling stories about it, it was kind of an ideal time to show up and see all of that. And some of the first stories I did were about scam artists and people who were taking advantage of that moment.
Before talking about Paul LaRue, we'd like to say a few words about an article that you wrote for Wired in 2009, and you actually did the front page, because I remember I subscribed to Wired around that time, and you did this article about vanishing in our digital world, and you disappeared for months while asking the community to find you. Could you tell us a little bit more about this experiment?
Yeah, it was 1 month. It felt like many months, but it was for 1 month. So the idea was, it actually arose because I was interested in people who fake their own death and how they do that and why they do that and what that's like and how you would do that in the digital age. If someone fakes their own death and disappears and does it successfully, then you can't find them just by virtue of them succeeding. You think they're dead. So you can't actually talk to the people who have done it well. You can only talk to the people who have done it poorly, who have failed and gotten caught. And I did that story actually and interviewed, you know, people who were in prison for doing that. And it just wasn't quite satisfying enough. So that's where the idea came from. Well, okay, maybe I could do something that sort of tries to replicate that experience. What is it like to adopt a new identity and leave your old one behind if people are chasing you? And for the people are chasing you part of it, we kind of hit upon the idea of letting the general public look for me and they could win a cash prize, which was $3,000. No, it was $5,000, actually. I put up $3,000 of the $5,000. And that kind of gave it a little more weight in terms of my desire to really make it feel real But it also got at some of the issues that I was interested in, which is, you know, what can people find out about you online? What, even at that time, and this now 10 years ago, you know, what could you get off of my social media feeds? What could you find out about my bank accounts and my addresses and everything just as an ordinary person? And it turned out it was an incredible amount, and it turned into this sort of epic chase where all these thousands of people were looking for me all over the country.
It was fantastic. I was personally looking for you around the country back in the day.
Really? That's funny.
Yeah. And you got caught, basically. Could you tell us a little bit more about how you got caught by some teenagers, if I remember well?
There was a teenager who was a primary player in it. So I got caught by a group of people who assembled online, did not know each other, but they kind of bubbled up in social media, on Twitter in particular, and a little bit on Facebook, where, you know, people would get together and start trading clues, things that they had figured out or theories that they had or hunches that they had. And the problem that group soon had was they realized that I was also on those services, not under my real name. So I was monitoring them. And so they went into kind of more and more private chat rooms to assemble and put their heads together and figure out how to catch me. And it was a group like that, which included a teenager who was really skilled at sort of figuring out IP addresses and where a person was located, given their IP address and tracking IP addresses. So he was in there, and there was another guy who'd worked for Microsoft who was very good. He set up a kind of trap for me on Facebook where he set up a site essentially within a group within Facebook that was purporting to be information about me. He knew that I would come to that site, and then he kind of combed all of the, you can't do this anymore on Facebook. They put a stop to it at the time. You could comb through all the visitors and track their IP addresses. So that they kind of triangulated around that, and they located where I was in New Orleans. And then they actually contacted people in New Orleans to go out and look for me. In particular, the owners of this gluten-free pizza place, because I have celiac disease, so I have to eat gluten-free. So it was a kind of a combination of technical prowess and determination, and then sort of on the ground making calls and mobilizing people to find me where I was. And so, yeah, they found me with only a couple days to spare before I would have quote unquote won.
Yeah, it was a fantastic experiment.
Would you do the same in 2020 if you tried to vanish again?
I don't think I would do the same. I mean, in some ways, it's amazing how the technology has not changed that much. I mean,
yeah.
In terms of if you kind of look around and you say, okay, how do I stay anonymous online? It's the same stuff. It's like Tor, you know, use Tor to hide your IP address, use VPNs. Like a lot of it is sort of the same, but the amount of data that's out there is even greater than it was, you know, when I was doing it. The protections haven't been put in place since then, and the amount of data we're bleeding off at all times is even greater. So I think it would be a lot harder to do now even than it was then, I would imagine. I mean, I have kids now, so I don't have any plans to reimagine it, but when I think about it, it seems more daunting to me just because there's so much more available to people.
Yeah.
And also the sophistication of people who are using those technologies to find things and find people has gone up. So if you look at, I don't know if you're familiar with Bellingcat, but you know, this organization, I think they're based out of the UK, but you know, they're always identifying, for instance, Russian agents, GRU agents in the UK or Eastern Europe. You know, and the ways they do it are so sophisticated. You know, they take one photo and analyze one part of the photo and say, aha, now we can find this street corner, and we can take the street corner, and we can go from there, and we can say, who is this person? You know, it's so sophisticated in a way that I think 10 years ago, sort of online sleuthing wasn't even that advanced. So you combine that with the amount of data that's out there, and I think there's just a lot more opportunity for people to catch people who were doing something like, if they were doing something like I was doing.
Let's talk a little bit about Paul LaRue, even since it's the main subject of your latest book, The Mastermind. Why did you choose this guy over, let's say, another drug lord or another big criminal or dark web organization? Why choosing Paul LaRue?
Well, there were a couple of reasons that I got so interested in Paul LaRue. One, I think, was just the initial mystery of it, which was that the way that I found out about Paul LaRue was, you know, one of his henchman, one of his, a guy who led his kill team named Joseph Hunter, whose nickname is Rambo. Mm-hmm. He was arrested in 2013. No, the world did not know anything about Paul LaRue at this time. And it was very mysterious why Joseph Hunter had been arrested. What were the steps that led to him? I mean, he was arrested in a sting operation. He was accused by the U.S. government of planning to kill a DEA agent in Liberia. So it was this kind of crazy story. And there was nothing behind it. So like, where did this guy come from? And like, why was he doing this in the first place? And so I was very intrigued by that story. And then, I can't even take credit for getting the name Paul LaRue, but eventually a great reporter at the Times, Alan Foyer, found out that Paul LaRue was the person who had hired Joseph Hunter. He was the person behind, the kill team. And that Paul LaRue himself had been arrested. And so that certainly, I was already kind of inclined to be very interested in that story. And I think even then, I almost dropped it because I just thought, well, we have the name, you know, we know who it is now. So maybe that's the whole story. But once I started poking around on what was available on Paul LaRue, and there wasn't much, he really was at the absolute intersection of my interests, you know, mm-hmm. online crime, the ways technology is influencing the world, online identity. And he had obviously kind of shifted from being this purely online figure in some sense. He was selling prescription painkillers over the internet to being a sort of real drug lord, you know, really operating in arms dealing, narcotics trafficking, and then violence and murder. Like, I already knew that because of Joseph Hunter. So there were all these sort of mysteries of how that happened and how someone builds a kind of empire like that. And it kind of, to your earlier question, it really piqued all of my interest from even the beginning of my career about, you know, the intersection of technology and society. And then it had this criminal intrigue in it that's obviously very captivating. It's captivating to me, at least.
Yeah, he's like a all-you-can-eat buffet for your interests.
Yeah, and almost, and in a way, I mean, as I did the story, I kind of mentioned this glancingly in the book, I think, but there were all these weird ways in which his life had like nearly intersected with mine, not truly intersected, but you know, we had both lived in Australia at the same time. Yeah. And then we had both lived in the Netherlands at the same time. And it was like a little bit eerie that we were kind of like, he was so nearby all the time. And I feel like that made me feel like, oh, I feel connected to this story, even though that's obviously just a random coincidence.
Did you know at the beginning that you would write a book, or did the idea come while you were investigating about Paul LaRue?
I knew pretty early that I wanted to write a book because I started mapping out a series. So at the time I was editing this magazine, the Atavist magazine, and we had wanted to do a kind of serialized crime story. Mm-hmm. We were trying to figure out what to do. And I thought, well, this will work really well for that. So I started like making almost like a map. Like here's how the series will go if we did six episodes. And as soon as I got to six episodes, I thought, oh wait, okay, well, it's gotta be seven because there's this. And this was just when I was just looking into it. I hadn't even made that many calls on it. And then I thought, oh, wait a minute, there could be eight, there could be 10. And then I thought, okay, well, we need to do a limited thing. And then I'm going to try to do a book because there's just so much in this that you couldn't possibly fit it into a shorter form if you really wanted to try to capture all the elements and themes of the story. So from pretty early on, I was hopeful. I mean, you still have to like convince a publisher to buy the book, but I had it in my mind that it would work as a book if I could get that far.
And how do you prepare for a big investigation like that?
Well, partly I had it was advantageous that I was kind of planning out this series. So I could sort of look at how to attack the reporting because there's so many places you can start.
Yeah.
I mean, you always have to start with doing some research and then calling some people. You always sort of hit this point where there's only so much online research or document research that you can do. And in this case, there was a huge amount of documents because there were court cases and some of them had a tremendous amount of paperwork behind them. But a lot of that information tends to be, you know, it's oriented around whatever's happening in the court proceedings. And you don't really know what's behind it until you start calling people. And I think it was when I started calling people and I started getting even lawyers that I thought would want to talk to me saying, no, I can't talk to you. I'm afraid for my life, or this is just not something I talk about, or hanging up on me. then I kind of thought, wow, okay, what I need to do is find anyone who will talk at length. Like, that was the first goal, was like, is there anyone inside the story who knows something who will actually tell me their experience, whether firsthand experience or whatever? And the first person to do that was this guy, Moran Oz, who is Israeli, and he was at the time accused as part of the prescription drug roundup that they'd done. They'd arrested a bunch of people associated with Toller's prescription drug business. And he was the first person, his lawyer let him talk to me, even though he was awaiting trial. And he said, okay, here's what happened, and told his whole story. And so from there, then you can really get going, because, you know, I had five names from him, from that interview. I start talking to those people, they give me names. And then once I had enough, then it was going to the Philippines, where the organization was based.
Did you even try to talk to the man himself?
I did try to talk to him. Yeah, I tried to talk to him a lot. Every lawyer that he ever had, I tried to get to that. I think that's seven lawyers at this point. But he didn't really have an incentive to talk to me, because he was cooperating with the government. He could only make things worse for himself by talking to me. His lawyers were also very scared as any lawyers I've ever seen. I mean, kept their name out of the court case entirely. Want their name to be involved in the court case, which is, that's very, very unusual in the U.S. court system. I couldn't find another example. The lawyers would either ignore me or they would hang up on me. And I had a lawyer, his most recent lawyer hung up on me, but like 3 weeks, 4 weeks ago. There's still a lot of secrecy around the case, particularly when I started. It was all supposed to be top secret, his participation, his cooperation. The government wasn't talking about it. So that aspect of it, I wasn't surprised that he never spoke to me. The people who worked for him, it was a little bit different. I mean, in some cases, in a lot of cases, they wanted to be anonymous, either because they were afraid of Paul or because they were afraid the U.S. government was going to come after them. And there were people I talked to who were under indictment by the U.S. government who didn't even know it. And so they were sort of rightfully afraid. But then it was sort of surprising that how much people did want to talk, you know, the people who did want to go on the record. I'm always a bit surprised by that, but I would always, you know, I would offer them the option if they wanted to be on background, meaning just, I would give them some moniker that wasn't their name, or if they wanted to be completely off the record where I wouldn't use anything, you know, it was pretty flexible because I was in it for the long game. So any particular interview in this case is not necessarily essential. Like, I'm trying to gather years worth of information that I can shape into the story. So there were times even when I had someone off the record and then I went back to them later and said, look, everyone knows this is you. Everyone's going to know. So would you just go on the record? And sometimes they said, yeah.
Do you think that some of these informants were looking for some sort of revenge towards Paul?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. And that's, from a journalistic perspective, that's one of the tricky things, is the motivations that people had. First of all, you have a lot of liars. I mean, a lot of these people are not telling the truth. And so it's trying to sort through who's telling the truth, who's aggrandizing themselves, which you wouldn't think people would do in this situation. You know, it's an illegal operation, but there were definitely people who were trying to make themselves seem bigger in the operation than they were. They wanted credit almost for having, you know, carried out this or that operation for Paul LaRue. And there were other people who were trying to minimize their role. So, and a lot of them were afraid of LaRue and also wanted to get back at him. So that was a big challenge, was just trying to triangulate information between people and documents and what I could prove and what I could show to figure out, like, where in here does the truth possibly lie? And also, honestly, some of the people were dead. Like, they had been murdered. And so it's very difficult to triangulate in that particular situation, you know, people's stories. So I struggled with that. I mean, I wrote about that some in the book because I wanted to kind of make clear that that was a struggle.
Why do you think he went to the Philippines to operate his business? It's only for low cost, for hiding, or do you know precisely?
I think initially, I mean, it was a combination of things from what I know, and again, I have not spoken to Paul. So this is everything that I know comes from things that he said in trial. He's testified at length. So he's talked about some of these kind of things and what he said to other people and, you know, relatives and people who worked for him. So I think there was a little bit of, like, he grew up in Zimbabwe in South Africa, and then he was living in the Netherlands, and he was sort of hard up for money, and it's cold and it's rainy. I mean, I lived in the Netherlands, and you know, the Philippines is sunny and warm. I think there was just a little bit of like, I want to get away and try something new, and I'm going to go to this tropical seeming place. Part of it was taxes, trying to avoid taxes on the business that he was starting, which was to sell prescription painkillers over the internet. And part of it was that they have a very robust call center industry there. So if you're going to run a big internet operation that sells things, you need some kind of infrastructure to deal with customer service, even if you're, what you're selling is a kind of gray area type product like prescription pills. Mm-hmm. So he could get into the call center business there. And then I think it's not clear if he went to the Philippines for this or just discovered it upon getting there. But, you know, the corruption in the judicial and political system in the Philippines was a huge factor in allowing him to operate his business. So I'm not sure whether that's the reason he went, but he certainly almost immediately took advantage of that, you know, bribing people to allow the business to function without any interference from the government.
Yeah.
You know, having paid informants inside the U.S. embassy, inside the Interpol office, like, yeah, he was able to kind of leverage his fortune to both keep himself out of trouble and to find out, you know, if there was trouble coming for him on the horizon.
And let's talk a little bit about his medication reselling business. Why do you think that he stayed so long under the radar running this business?
Well, partly it was the format of the business. I mean, this is kind of the genius of Paul LaRue, was the way that he set up the business. So
because it was even not on the dark web. It was on the surface web. So
exactly. Yeah. It was out in the open. So, you know, he's operating out of the Philippines. There are these websites, I mean, hundreds of websites, if not thousands of websites, selling these prescription drugs that are actually, he's behind them. So his company, RX Limited, is behind them. But you wouldn't know that by looking at them. They have all kinds of names. And the orders from those websites are going to American doctors that he's recruited into a network to write prescriptions. And American pharmacists are then enlisted to send the prescriptions to American customers. I mean, the entire drug sales operation existed within the United States of America, but he was operating it from the Philippines. And so that disconnect made it really, really hard for even if a, you know, law enforcement was interested in chasing it, which a lot of, there were some DEA investigators who pursued it for many years, but they didn't get much support from anywhere else in the DEA. And part of the reason is, you know, you could go raid a pharmacy in the US, and even if it was a RX Limited sponsored pharmacy, basically, you know, they were shipping pills for Paul LaRue's organization. They didn't even know. They'd never heard of Paul LaRue. They probably never even heard of RX Limited. They only heard of some random shell company that Paul LaRue had set up to send them money. So you couldn't really get anywhere. You had to trace the connections all the way back to the Philippines. And that's just very time consuming and expensive and difficult and intellectually challenging, because you're dealing with someone with almost unlimited resources. He's making hundreds of millions of dollars, and he's a technical genius. So he's able to hide himself and his businesses behind layers of identities and shell companies and everything else. And so that combination made it just a brilliant scheme. And funny enough, I mean, he made some mistakes, because I think in the very early when he was launching the business, I mean, it wasn't clear that anyone was paying attention, that any law enforcement body was tracking this at all, because frankly, they weren't. In 2004, 2005, barely paying any attention to this at all. And he's selling non-controlled drugs, drugs that are not controlled under the U.S. drug control regime. So they're lesser known. And so he put his name on a couple of things. He, at the very beginning, he put his name on, I think, a mail drop in the U.S. and a server rental in Canada. He was using servers from a couple of companies in Canada. And I think when he started, he thought, well, no one's paying any attention to this at all. It didn't even seem like something that law enforcement would spend the time to go dig up who's renting the servers. And he was right. No one was paying attention to it. But then years later, when they came back, you know, those were the couple places he couldn't get his name off of. You know, they existed in the records. And so that's part of what tripped him up. Is by 2008, 2009, he was really, really good. And he was behind layers and layers. And they probably wouldn't have even known his name or who he was if not for those couple of mistakes that he made at the very beginning.
And it's pretty often like that, even if I recall, it was the case for Ross Ulbricht from the Silk Road. It was also the case with Alexander Kaz, who is actually a guy from Quebec who ran the Alpha B for multiple years. It's always when you go back at the very beginning that you find those beginner's mistakes, like an email, a Gmail address that is put somewhere in the very first email that he's trying to create. So it always goes back to the very beginning, and that's where we usually find the mistakes they made.
Yeah, I mean, I think it could be that no one really believes in themselves enough that they think down the line, I'm going to be worth, you know, Paul LaRue, I'm going to be worth hundreds of millions, if not like close to $1 billion. Law enforcement agencies from all over the world are going to be chasing me. You know, to project that forward 8 years and say, okay, so I shouldn't put my name on this initial server when I'm just starting a business that's nothing. I'm starting it out of nowhere. That kind of foresight, it'd just be very, very difficult to do. So I think that's probably what happened in all those cases. They didn't realize how big they were going to get.
Yeah. There's a big difference between selling medication online and providing countries with weapons and also hiring mercenaries. How and why do you think that he went that far?
Well, I know how he went that far. Why he went that far is probably the biggest mystery that drove me in the book, and I don't know that I necessarily cracked it. But, I mean, essentially the how is, you know, he was making all this money selling these prescription drugs, and one option for him, which he did consider, was sort of going legit, like saying, okay, I'm going to take all that money and plow it into regular investments. You know, he talked about building office buildings in Manila and making investments in Dubai. And there were all these possibilities available to him. He could have invested in startups. He could have started a venture fund, you know, all sorts of things. But when he saw the returns that you could get from criminal activities, they're just way, way higher than any investment that you're going to make anywhere. So he decided that if he wanted to kind of multiply his empire, the way to do it was illegally. And, you know, there's a way in which once you get into a few illegal operations, other doors kind of open up for you. So, you know, he was sort of just sending people around trying to figure out how to get into different businesses. You know, he might send someone to Colombia or send someone to Mexico or Peru and say, you know, see if you can make some drug connections, or maybe they had a couple of connections, and, you know, see what you can do with this. And, you know, if that person came back with nothing, or if that person got beat up or killed, it's no loss to him. You know, we'll try somewhere else. And like, eventually that was effective. And the same thing happened with arms trading, you know, just sending people to Iran and saying, let's make some connections there, and let's see if we can do some deals with the Iranian government. That's in fact exactly what he did in the end, was sell weapons to the Iranian government. The why is, I think, some combination of the idea of multiplying his money, so just pure greed. But there's a sort of ancillary idea to greed, which I think you find in the startup community all the time, which is, it's sort of encapsulated in like growth. Like, why does Mark Zuckerberg want to grow Facebook more and more? Like, what is his goal? Why does Elon Musk continue to start new businesses and try? And he could retire. And the same was true of Paul LaRue. Like, he could have retired and lived the rest of his life. Yeah. But there's something about trying to become the biggest, become the best. It's ego, it's money, it's power, it's all those things. And at some level, Paul LaRue wanted to be the biggest, most diversified criminal in the world. That was one of his goals. And so he branched out into everything that he could come up with. And his mind worked in this way that he could just come up with new ideas. You know, let's try to do a coup in the Seychelles. Let's try to start something in Somalia. Let's try to do black market gold mining. Let's have timber operations. Like, his mind is working all the time. And so it's similar to a Silicon Valley, you know, mogul who says, oh, let's start a new business. Let's do this. Let's do online this. You know, it's something you can't turn off, I think, once you're successful in particular. Like, there's nothing constraining you.
Yeah. Even, are you sometimes afraid of being killed by him after revealing so much information about his life in your book?
Not now, I would say. I tried not to think about it too much, even at the time. I think my concerns were not actually him for most of the time. My concerns were the people who worked for him.
He had
mercenaries and hitmen who worked for him, many of whom are still at large, and some of whom I talked to or met with. And so, you know, those people are a concern. But generally, what I found is that the incentive to do anything to me is pretty small. Like, the only time when someone really, there's two reasons why someone would, you know, do something to a journalist. The first one is to keep information from coming out. And in this case, when I was approaching people, I mostly already knew that they were involved. So I think a lot of them just wanted to know, well, how did you find me? Or, you know, or they wanted to tell their story. Well, okay, well, if you're gonna talk about this, tell this part of the story, because this is what happened to me. So that was part of it. And then the other reason might be revenge. But I think, you know, for Paul LaRue's revenge purposes, the list is probably pretty long. So maybe I'm on it, maybe I'm not. He might like that I wrote a book about him. He might hate it. Yeah. I mean, it's hard for me to tell, but also he's in prison. So I wouldn't say it's something that I think about much.
They have some rumor. Do you believe he is the creator of the Bitcoin technology? I suppose you heard about that.
Oh yeah. I wrote a story about that for Wired last summer. It's a complicated question. It seems like a very simple question. Do I think that he is the creator of Bitcoin, whose pseudonym is Satoshi Nakamoto? And a lot of people do think that he is, or is a very good candidate for. Yeah. I would say, I think that he is a very good candidate considering the candidates that we know about. So a lot of people have been named as possible Satoshi Nakamotos, and some of them are clearly not, and some of them are very likely candidates. And I think he's in the category of a likely candidate. His biography matches up, his skill set matches up for creating Bitcoin. But I also think in the universe of candidates that exists in the world, he's probably very unlikely. Like, I don't think it's him ultimately, partly because I spent years, you know, looking into him, and nobody really talked about Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, you know, which again, people, you could just say, well, that's because he was so good at being secretive about it. Maybe, that's possible, but there's certain aspects of, his biography that I feel like they would line up even better if it was him, you know, and I've done code comparisons and all sorts of things, and there's no smoking gun. And I think as much as I've looked, if there was a smoking gun, I'd like to think I would have found it, but who knows? I mean, no one knows. He kind of threw everyone for a loop because in his statement at his sentencing, which was just a few weeks ago, he said that the thing that he was going to do if they let him loose was he was going to mine Bitcoin using this special technology that he'd come up with. And so it's very unclear why he would choose to say that.
It makes no sense
that he would say that. And I don't think it makes it likely that he's Satoshi. If anything, maybe he's just messing with everyone at this point. I'm not sure. Yeah. But it was very striking and odd, and it certainly didn't serve to quell the rumors that it might be him.
I want to know, do you have any updates since the publishing of the book about his ex-wives and his children, Cindy and Lilia?
I mean, I do know more about them. It's interesting you should bring that up. But I wouldn't say more about them because, like, they're in the book because they were parties to the organization that he was involved in. I mean, for instance, his first wife was arrested in Hong Kong, trying to retrieve money for the business when they were confiscating money. In his sentencing, it sort of became a point of contention that the defense argued that one of the reasons he should be released, actually, or released into the custody of the Philippines, was that his family had been put in danger by press reports, including mine. And my argument to that is, like, both those names were already in the press prior to my writing anything about Paul LaRue. So I'm not responsible for putting his current or ex-wife's name into the world, but I do try to avoid talking much about, I know kind of where they are and what they're up to, and I hear things about them, and people say, oh, they're doing this or that, but I that part of the story, like, I feel like they are sort of partially victims of this whole situation. I mean, especially the kids, like the kids are not mentioned in my book and by name. I know their names, but like, I feel like they truly are victims of everything that happened.
Of course, being dads ourselves, we were a little bit worried about his kids. So we just want to make sure that they're okay.
Yeah, he's got kids and nobody knows where they are. I mean, I tried to track down some of his like mistresses in Brazil, and they had disappeared. So no one really knows what happened to those kids.
Are there any question you'd like to ask LaRue that you haven't had answered?
Well, of course, the Satoshi one is that's the big one. I mean, I think the answer is no. So I think ultimately it would be a little disappointing if it is yes. Of course, like it's one of the biggest stories in the world. So I for sure would like to know that, or at least one of the biggest tech stories in the world. I think there are lots of things that are sort of very particular to my investigation, you know, things that I could never quite get to the bottom of, why he did this or that, you know, why did he have this timber operation and then he just completely abandoned it all of a sudden out of nowhere? And he actually left a bunch of people stranded.
Yeah, right.
It's things like that, which are not, they're not like that salient to the story overall. They're just sort of these minor details. But I think in listening to his testimony, I think the questions that I ultimately wanted answered from a kind of why did you do this perspective, as you were asking before, I don't even know if he could answer them. You know, it's hard to tell when someone testifies because he's trying to sort of sound contrite, although he wasn't very good at sounding contrite. But he didn't seem very self-reflective in anything that I've seen. And so I think that's the kind of conversation I would love to have. It's like, you know, when this started getting big, like, what did you think? I've seen chats that he had with people. He seemed scared at certain points, or he seemed, you know, and to have that kind of real conversation of what was this experience like for you, I don't think that'll ever be possible.
And about his sentencing, even, do you think that he would be scared to be deported to the Philippines because he might face murder charges there?
Yes. I mean, I know so. I know he was scared to be deported to the Philippines. I mean, he was afraid. So they don't have the death penalty in the Philippines, but he actually was afraid that they would reinstitute the death penalty just to kill him. That was sort of one of the arguments that he made at a certain point. Wow. But then during his sentencing, or right before his sentencing, he kind of reversed course because he wanted the U.S., like the federal judge in the U.S., to give him time served. And he claimed that he would not resist extradition to the Philippines and he would face charges in the Philippines and he would actually admit to everything he did in the Philippines and face his punishment there. I think it's hard not to be suspicious of that, that maybe the thinking was, well, if I could just get to the Philippines, maybe the same strategy that I used before, paying, for instance, millions of dollars to judges and politicians, could actually get me completely free. You know, like the U.S., for all of its current corruption in various ways, that's a thing you still can't do. It's like you generally cannot bribe a federal judge to change your sentence. But he successfully did that in the Philippines. So I think in his mind, it might be, maybe I'll take my chances there rather than face what he eventually got, which is 25 years in a U.S. prison where there's just no getting out. Like there's no way around it. You cannot get out unless your appeal is successful. So I think he was afraid. I think then maybe they had second thoughts, whether it was just a strategy or he really thought like, well, I'll just go face the music there and see what happens. It's not totally clear.
And is there anything that you learned throughout your investigation that you didn't put in the book because of risks or legal reasons? Is there anything that that you just told yourself, oh no, I shouldn't write it?
I don't think there was anything I didn't put in there because of risks. I think the stuff that I didn't put in was either because it was very personal to certain people who were, you know, either speaking to me off the record or on background and asked me not to put it in, or it would put someone else at risk. So there were all these dilemmas with people who were speaking sort of anonymously or semi-anonymously, where they would say, you know, I'm afraid someone's going to kill me. And so just don't, you know, don't burn me. I don't want to get burned. I want to tell you the story, but I don't want to get burned. But then the problem is they would not really be thinking about what would burn them when they're talking to me. And it's very difficult for me to tell. So, you know, when someone says, I grew up here, or I lived here before I went to the Philippines, or this was my job before, like, I don't know if there are people out there that would connect the dots and recognize this person. So that became a kind of constant dilemma for me. Like, how much of what they've actually told me should I use if I, the main goal of keeping them anonymous is so that they won't face some sort of retribution that they're afraid of. So I struggled with that a lot. And at times I would just pare things back farther than I would like to. Like, the story would have been better if I could have included a few more details, but I wanted to kind of stay on the safe side. So
for sure,
that's probably the kind of stuff that I left out.
Because we sometimes feel that all of these things are just the tip of the iceberg, you know, because when we start digging and we learn about this, you know, this timber business or, okay, this weapons trafficking ring and all that stuff, we cannot stop thinking about what else did he do? I mean, did he go into sex trafficking, human trading, things like that? There's so many things, so many stories that it's easy to think that it's just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. Well, it can really mess with your mind because in my process of reporting it, I was sort of kept running into things that people would mention to me as rumors. You know, oh, I heard that he was building a drones to deliver drugs, and I'd be like, okay, sure.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, come on. And then, you know, a month later I would talk to a Philippine police officer who was like, oh yeah, we were doing surveillance on him and he was building drones to deliver drugs out of this warehouse and here's where it was and blah blah blah. And then it comes out in the trial, he was building drones. Like, wow. There were so many incidents like that about his operation in Somalia or selling arms to Iran. I mean, I thought that was nonsense the first time I heard it, and it was true. And so then you get to where you can believe anything. And, you know, I put a couple of things in there. Like, there was an incident that was sort of like sex trafficking where he kept wanting to have women brought to him in Manila. And, you know, he was maybe going to have a bunch of children that then could like grow up and work for him. And I kind of included that because it was such an example of like how extreme, like I talked to the guy who was like, yes, I did that for him. That was my job. And it was just like, okay, at this point, like, I don't even know what would not be believable. Like, is there anything someone could tell me? And the thing that turned out to be not believable to me was that he had captured all of Muammar Gaddafi's gold and like shipped it out of Libya. Like, a lot of people said that to me. And then when I looked into it, there was just nothing there. Like, I don't know. It's possible, but like, I don't think that one's true. But those rumors would grow because, of course, like you're saying, like, is anything you could say? And you'd say like, oh, he built a nuclear weapon? Yeah, sure. I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, he planned a moon landing or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Ivan Ratliff. It was a pleasure to talk about Paul LaRue. Your book, The Mastermind, is still available everywhere. That's such an incredible and unbelievable story. So I suggest everyone to go and read the book. Thank you very much for your time, Ivan. And I hope you enjoyed the talk.
Much so. Thank you. Thanks, guys. Thanks, guys.